Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
And this is London, but of course coming to you all over the world thanks to the wonders of the internet. The visual and audio audience of this show undoubtedly makes it the biggest show of its kind anywhere in the entire world. So you're in good company here. Tell someone else about it. Won't you? Now, in addition to the things I've mentioned already, we will be talking, of course, about 9/11. 9/11, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist, and I am not. In fact, the conspiracy theorists imagine I am a part of the conspiracy. But you don't have to be one of those to know that there are many things about what happened on 9/11, 2001, that we do not yet know or understand, and that is partly a result of deliberate obfuscation, hiding of truths that we have a right to know, not just because of the enormous death toll that was created on the day of the attack on the Twin Towers and other targets, but because of the world-shaking reverberations which ensued, and which ensued to this day. The earth is still shaking as a result of what happened in the United States on 9/11. John Duffy is an author and an activist, and his book, The Watchdogs Didn't Bark, is the product of a decade of intense study and an investigation, frankly, of the many mysteries that still surround that subject. And it's important. It's important not just for our American audience. It's important to everybody in the world. We'll be talking, as I said, about the tremendous spike in coronavirus cases in Britain over the last 24 hours, very nearly doubled in 24 hours. Well over 1,000 new cases were reported. We won't know, of course, how many fatalities or even hospitalizations that will result from that. But if it doubles again tomorrow, if it doubles again the next day, we are in very serious trouble, both in terms of our ability to withstand such an assault on our parlously underfunded, over-privatized, and enfeebled public services, but also our entire economy, already in a 20% recession and with mass unemployment already here, with millions more lost jobs coming down the pipeline. And if you think it's bad here, well, we'll be taking a look at the United States, where it is much, much worse. We'll be talking also about this subject of Korea. I did a broadcast this week. You can see it on the YouTube for the Workers' Party on the 75th anniversary of the defeat and surrender of Japanese fascism. I tried in that talk to adumbrate the scale of the crimes committed by Japanese fascism and ask one or two pertinent questions. Namely, how come Japan after the war was endlessly rewarded, was never punished in any way for the crimes that it committed between 1937 and 1945. How come the people who resisted Japanese fascism quickly became America's enemies, and the state which produced Japanese fascism quickly became a golden boy to be endlessly rewarded, built up in the fashion of a dagger held at the heart of North Korea, of Vietnam, and of course the big enchilada of China. And in the course of my discussion, I touched on the tremendous crimes that the Japanese fascist empire committed, of course, against China, most notably of all, 20 million Chinese may have perished in that war, second only to the then Soviet Union in terms of sacrifice made for the defeat of fascism. But Korea, which the northern part at least is forever being painted as the bad guy. But actually, Japanese fascism completely devastated Korea. And not long afterwards, the United States completely devastated it again. And so it's always worth looking at Korea. But we'll be talking to a woman who has translated a book about the systematic, industrialized use of sexual slavery of Korean women by the fascist Japanese army. Hundreds of thousands of Korean women were taken into forcible sexual slavery, and none of them have been compensated in the post-war era. And we'll be talking also to Dr. Deepa Driver, who's an academic and a trade unionist, on the issue of Julian Assange. The courtroom drama of the century begins tomorrow at the Old Bailey in London, where the hearing to decide whether Julian Assange, the world's greatest journalist and publisher, is to be sent to the United States forcibly, extradited, to face trumped-up charges that would put him in prison for 175 years. We would literally never see or hear from Julian Assange again. A man who exposed crimes against humanity, war crimes against the taxpayers of our own countries, a man who blew the whistle, who published the truth, the incontrovertible truth, never contradicted truth, is facing incarceration for the rest of his life. Just think about that. I've been thinking about it day and night for many years now, but too many people have not thought about it at all. So we'll be covering, of course, that story. There are other breaking stories in Britain and in the United States. The attempt to finally kill Donald Trump's presidency is underway with the, I suppose you might call them, disgruntled former employees of Trump, who are now telling us, now, only now, that he had endless, bottomless contempt for the soldiers in the United States Army, those who came back disabled from America's wars, or those who lie in the ground in military cemeteries, having lost their lives in America's wars. Now, you can believe the word of these whistleblowers or not. There's no evidence, of course. It's a matter of judgment as to which liars you believe. I believe that Donald Trump is an inveterate liar. I believe he's a pathological liar. I believe he's a psychologically disturbed liar. But I don't believe these particular lies. You can tell us what you think. You can tell us on the poll, by the way. There was foreign interference in the poll last week. And somehow, Joe Biden's vote got transcribed for Donald Trump's vote and vice versa. At least that's what's being alleged. So, you'll need to vote again. If you could vote in the US election, who would you vote for? A, Joe Biden. B, Donald Trump. C, Jesse Ventura. Vote now on my Twitter feed, and I promise I'll make sure the result is absolutely true and verifiable by the end of this poll. So you can vote on my Twitter feed right now. There it is. It's on the screen right in front of you. We've slightly changed the order into alphabetical, which is what it should have been from the beginning. And there was apparently a brouhaha in the back room here that caused this hiccup, shall we call it. So with due apologies to all concerned, you're going to have to vote again on that. Jesse Ventura, of course, is not certain to be on the ballot paper, but the better he does tonight, maybe the more encouraging that will be. But there's a breaking story in Britain today. Yet another stabbing rampage in Birmingham, the second city of the United Kingdom. For some reason, the authorities are not releasing any description of the stabber who murdered one person and critically wounded two others and lightly wounded several others. A woman was stabbed repeatedly in the neck. The knife man has not been apprehended, so is still at large. But for some reason, the police in the West Midlands of England have not released any description of this man. Whatever happened to all points bulletins? How are we supposed to help the police identify this person if we don't know anything, and I mean anything, about what he looks like? And of course, this has led to a day of speculation, which could be completely baseless, of what the identity people think this knife man may have. The police have said it's not terrorism. They've said it's not hate. It sounds pretty hateful to me, but not hate, i.e. not motivated by the specificities of his victims, either their colour, their sexual orientation, or anything else. Now, if both those things are true, it's, to me, inexplicable why we don't know who we are looking for or who the police are looking for. And I want to use it to expand upon a thesis that I have now accepted and acted on. Life in Britain's biggest cities is becoming intolerable for a whole range of reasons. I've been living in London, on and off, back and forward between London and Scotland since 1983. And now I'm leaving. I'm leaving with my ever-growing family because it's no longer a place that I consider safe for my children to grow up in. It's no longer a place where I can move around. Anyone who's driving in London already knows what I mean. It's not a safe place, it's not an affordable place, and that is true of New York, it's true of London, and people who can, as by the grace of God I can, are moving out. The crime on the streets in London is simply intolerable. I was living in one of the toughest boroughs in London, in Brent. We left Brent in a hurry, almost with the teapot still warm on the stove, when someone discharged 11 rounds of automatic weapon ammunition in the street next to us. My 13-year-old son asked me if he could go to the shop 200 yards away to buy something, and I told him no. Now, if your 13-year-old cannot walk 200 yards to the shop because the father rationally fears what might happen to the child out on the street for his trainers, for his watch, for his phone, that is becoming literally unbearable. And I want to hear from people what they think about life in the cities of Britain and the United States. And before you quote it, I always quote it. Dr. Johnson's aphorism, the man who's tired of London is tired of life. Well, I'm in no way tired of life, but I do value life, particularly the life of my own children, and I'm no longer prepared to risk those lives here in the great metropolis of London. I've actually spent the last few days walking in the woods. I know I said I never would, but I was accompanied by a hearty crew of fit young men and women, because I was completing the filming on Killing Kelly. We were reconstructing the last hours, minutes, seconds of Dr. David Kelly's life. The grass was wet. It rained. I've come back with a cold. So you don't have to worry about me shouting this week, as some of you rather oddly fixate upon. This is the nearest I'll ever be to vulnerable. So come and have a go if you think you're hard enough. Call me, tweet me, get involved. This is the Open University of the Airwaves. I'm the teacher, but I like when students talk back to the teacher. Now, John Duffy, as I said, is an author, a writer, a documentary maker, and he studied for 10 years the many mysteries of 9/11. He's not a conspiracy theorist, and neither am I. If he were, he wouldn't be here. But you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to know that there are quite a few things, very significant things, not right about the official story on 9/11, that somebody is covering something up. No better man than John Duffy to ask about it. John, welcome to the mother of all talk shows. It's a privilege to interview you. Your book, The Watchdogs Didn't Bark. Explain that title, if you would, to the audience. In what way did the watchdogs not bark?
So I guess it's kind of complicated, but in essence, we have a variety of government institutions in this country. So we have our NSA, the National Security Agency. We have the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, the FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation. So with the 9/11 case, there's a lot of details, but I guess specifically one I could give you that would show the watchdogs not barking, for instance, was the National Security Agency maintains like electronic surveillance sort of around the world. There was a particular house in Sana'a, Yemen, that was owned by the father-in-law of one of the would-be 9/11 hijackers, Khalid Al-Midar. And when Al-Midar had come to the United States in 2000, along with another future hijacker, Nawaf al-Hazmi, they were living in San Diego, and they made many communications back to this house in Sana'a, Yemen. Well, this house happened to be a phone hub, a communications hub, if you will, for the Al-Qaeda network. And the NSA was aware of this house, was monitoring the signals, intelligence in and out of this house. And the CIA actually was as well. And so they could clearly see at that time that they had two individuals in the United States, in San Diego, California, communicating fairly regularly with this very, very important Al-Qaeda communications hub in Yemen. And of course, seemingly, nothing was made of that. And it's like, these are the watchdogs watching. But of course, the attacks then proceed and succeed.
And were these individuals attending flying school?
They were. They did attend flying school, and then they did also, take English lessons and things like that. And they were, if you look at the chronology of their time in the United States, they were interacting with other individuals who were of suspicion, some who, would also end up being part of the 9/11 plot. So they were, and not only were they being watched while they were in the United States, what's very important and sort of integral to our book is that they were being watched before they came to the United States. In late 1999, there was a summit in Malaysia of Al-Qaeda operatives and actors. It's called the Al-Qaeda Planning Summit, if you will. And this happened in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. And the U.S. intelligence services were very, very well aware of it. They were tracking people on their way there. With the assistance of Malaysian intelligence, they were monitoring the meeting as it went down, taking photographs and videos outside of that meeting. And it's pretty much presumed that this is the meeting in which the not only the 9/11 attack was planned, but also the attack on the USS Cole that happened in the port of Aden. And So they're watching this meeting unfold. They're watching the people coming in and out. Two of those people are Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midar. And they actually were able to get a copy of al-Midar's passport made, which included his U.S. visa, his multiple entry visa. And then they see them travel to the United States after that and, you know, land in L.A. where they move to San Diego. And, of course, they're watching them all the way up to that. But the second they get to the United States, it's like, poof, you know, where did all this concern go? Where did the monitoring go?
Yeah, I mean, that opens the question. And I know you've got 1,000 other examples, but if we stick with this one, that opens the question of whether or not the watchdogs were stupid or wicked. It's a bit difficult to know which would be worse. Did they fail because they were too stupid to know that people in touch with Al-Qaeda attending flying school in the United States was a potential danger? Or was there wickedness involved? Were they deliberately not closing these people down, capturing these people for some nefarious purpose?
So what our book posits and tries to defend through interviews with people from FBI, CIA, NSA, the White House, the DOD, and even some anonymous sources, what we postulate and try to defend is something that was brought to us by the former the highest counterterror official in the United States, one Richard Clark, who worked for both Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. So this is the highest counterterror official in the United States at the time. And when we sat down and spoke with him in 2009, what he, again, was speculating, admittedly, was that what was happening here was that within the CIA's counterterror center, so people like Kofor Black and then even the head, George Tenet, they were basically seeing this as an opportunity. When these individuals were coming to the United States, they were seeing it as an opportunity to get intelligence within Al-Qaeda from these guys, probably with the assistance of Saudi proxies. And they didn't want the FBI to know about it because they knew that the FBI counterterror program, especially under the sort of hard charging by the book John O'Neill out of New York, would not allow this, would clamp down, would arrest these men right away and try them for crimes. And so the CIA says, look, we can't do that. These hotheads in the FBI, they'll botch it. And what we have here is a real opportunity. So what they did was try to create sort of a reporting network with these guys here. And then they did not shut that operation down. And then when it became clear that it was a disaster, they did everything they possibly could to cover their own asses. I'm sorry, to cover for themselves and their actions. And they and then further went on to seek more power through the administration. When, you know, when the Bush administration said, well, what do we do now? It was the CIA who came to them at Camp David and said, hey, if you cut the chains, if you let us have all the powers that we want, you know, renditions, torture, espionage, that, you know, we'll get these guys for you because we really know them. And our book goes on to then catalog how the people who tried to do the right thing, people who tried to blow the whistle, ended up finding themselves prosecuted, and people who did the wrong thing, who broke the law, who lied and covered up for themselves, they climbed the ladder of power.
For anyone who's seen the television series Looming Tower, this story of turf war is quite familiar. The FBI, with its responsibility, constitutional responsibility, to defend the homeland, was effectively kept out of the loop. Is that what you're saying, John?
Yeah, I'm very much so. We spoke with Lawrence Wright, who wrote The Looming Tower, before we wrote our book. And we spoke with many of the FBI agents that he spoke with in writing his book. And it seems very clear on a handful of occasions, there are perfect moments where sharing this information from the CIA to the FBI, it's right there in front of them, and the CIA makes sure it doesn't happen. This happened immediately upon the the arrival of Alameda Arnold Hazmi in the United States, when FBI agents who were detailed to the bin Laden unit at CIA, agents like Mark Rossini and Doug Miller, were asking for permission to send that information back to FBI counterterror, and they were denied. It happened again in June of 2001 when FBI agents like Ali Soufana, Steve Bongar, who were investigating the attack on the coal, were having an information sharing meeting with the CIA, and they would not give over the names of people who were relevant in the fact that these people were all who were planning the coal and planning 9/11 were all together in the Malaysia summit. And there is even a more esoteric example with a source that had been found overseas who was giving information to both the CIA and the FBI, but the CIA would only ask him particular questions when the FBI man was out of the room. There were plenty of opportunities for the information about these Al-Qaeda operatives being in the United States to be shared with the FBI, and it looks like a very, very deliberate decision not to share it.
So not stupid, but wicked in effect. Because its effect is almost impossible to compute, not just the thousands who died on the day, but the millions, perhaps, who've died in the reverberations, and certainly the reverberations to come, because, of course, it was a long time ago, 19 years, but the earth is still shaking around the world.
It is. It is. And, I mean, you have the poor, you know, the people around the world who've suffered physically, lost family members, lost limbs, been displaced, you know, been pushed out of their home country. I mean, those are the people, obviously, I truly feel for. But then we also have, you know, losses of freedoms, more intrusion, larger bureaucracy, you know, more expensive bureaucracy, all of these things that are knock-on effects of that, you know, the torture program, like a total loss of international credibility. There are so many outgrowths of this that really, like, could have and should have been avoided.
Who takes political responsibility for this, John? I know that no one did at the time. But, I mean, is it the president? Is it the Defense Department? Who must be blamed in the history books, at least?
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I mean, you know, beyond speculation for who knew what when, like if you could say for a fact, that gets pretty hard. I personally think a lot of blame lies at CIA Director George Tenet's feet. I think the head of the NSA at the time, Michael Hayden, should be bearing some of that responsibility. I definitely think a lot belongs at the feet of, you know, George Bush and Dick Cheney and their administration. You know, you can't be in charge of all these people. Have these people directly working under you and that doing this and not take some of that responsibility. I think there's a lot to go around. But, you know, the intelligence institutions in this country, from the time of their existence, they bear a lot of responsibility. But from what they've been designed to do and how they've affected it over the years, you know, the CIA themselves, just as an institution, brought up to lie, brought up to be underhanded and that sort of thing. It's,
well, Pompeo boasted about it recently.
Excuse me, what was that?
Pompeo was boasting about it recently. We lied, we cheated, we robbed.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they were, under their belief structure, that's what they think that they are there to do. And they're true believers. You have to understand, just like extremists of any kind. They are true believers. They believe that when they lie, when they kill, when they assassinate, when they kidnap, when they rendition, when they torture, that they are doing it for a good reason. They think the ends justify the means, you know, and that's what makes them so dangerous.
Where can people read your book? Where can people follow your work, John?
This book can be found at, you know, any major book retailer should have it. It's available to all the major online sellers. We do have a website, watchdogsbark.com, where you can find not only the book, some of the other media interviews we've done, but also some of the material leading up to this book, other articles we've written. So that's watchdogsbark.com. And again, the name of the book is The Watchdogs Didn't Bark, CIA, NSA, and the Crimes of the War on Terror.
I think you're going to sell a few copies off this interview tonight. John Duffy, you deserve it. Thanks. You've done us all a service with your 10 years of study of this subject. John Duffy, the author of The Watchdogs Didn't Bark. Let me take a quick break. Now, Ko-Ahn Lee is a Korean-English interpreter and translator. She grew up in Korea and currently lives in Chicago. She translated a book from Korean to English written by an activist who directly helped the former sex slaves in Korea over the last 30 years. The book is about the history of the Japanese sexual slavery system and the lives of the victims. There are only 17 of these victims left alive in Korea as of May of this year. And this is the only one who have reported themselves as sex slaves. Out of approximately 200,000 Korean women taken, only about 230 reported to the Korean government. The book is called 25 Years of Wednesdays, and it really is quite gripping reading. The women were treated, as the name suggests, as comfort women for the Japanese fascist army as it went about its death and destruction on a grand scale in Korea. And Ko-Ahn Lee has kindly agreed to join us. I hope she's with us now. Ko-Ahn, thank you for that. It's a very harrowing story, the more harrowing for the fact that no justice or anything remotely approaching justice has ever been forthcoming. The Japanese state today does not acknowledge these crimes, has not atoned for them, and certainly has not made reparation for them. Is that true?
Hello, George. Hi. Thank you for having me. And yes, it is true that the Japanese government has denied its responsibilities for these war crimes that they had committed during the war. And they did make a few gestures, only gestures, to show the world that they are atoned and they would like to resolve this issue well. However, that is not what the victims and survivors wanted, and the victim survivors refused to take those offers.
What were the offers, just so we can dispose of them?
So there were a few. So in 1965, first, that was under the Korean military dictatorship at the time, South Korea only, though. And the Japanese government and the South Korean government made a treaty, or signed on a treaty that is called the 1965 Treaty on Basic Resolutions. And there, Japan agreed to pay South Korea $300 million and landed $200 million for 10 years. And that money never went to the victims of the war crimes or, you know, the war in general, never went to those women. And that money actually was used for domestic industrial development of South Korea at the time, which was pocketed by the mega conglomerates that are controlling the South Korean economy right now. And after that, in the 90s, Japan was pushed to make something, a deal, or Japan was asked to do something about it, because there were some international community pressure to towards Japan, and they made recommendations to resolve this issue. So Japan provided Asian Women's Funds, which they named a healing fund. It's not a reparation, or they never admitted the crimes that they committed. They just said that we feel somewhat sorry about what happened to you, so we want to, you know, give this money to you. And that was also rejected from the victims. And recently in 2015, there was a bilateral agreement made by the governments of South Korea and Japan, and that deal was made, you know, behind the doors, closed behind the doors, and so quickly. The whole process was only for a couple weeks, when those foreign ministers of Japan and South Korea met and discussed. And then they never told those victim survivors what they were talking about and what they are going to agree with. And they suddenly announced on December 28th that Japan and Korea agreed to resolve this issue, the Japanese military sexual slavery comfort women issue now. So Japan is paying 1 billion yen, which is $8.8 at the time, and nobody knows how the calculation came from. And there were a number of conditions that Japan demanded, not Korea, South Koreans or the vast majority of victims demanded, but Japan demanded to stop the protest, no more mentioning this issue in the international communities, demolishing statues that's commemorating these victims and war crimes, and etc. So that was the most recent one, and majority of the victims refused to take the money.
Now, this has been characteristic of Japan's approach: knock down the statues, stop demonstrating outside our embassy. But the surviving women, every Wednesday, still, even though they are in their 90s, still demonstrate. Yes. There, don't they?
They still are doing, at this time, due to COVID, they are doing this protest virtually. However, they never stopped since January 8th, 1992, since the first Wednesday demonstration began. And many of the victims, you said earlier that 17 victims remain alive. However, one more survivor passed away just a week ago. So as of now, it's 16 remain alive in South Korea. And many of them are on wheelchairs or difficult to get up or, you know, make a speech or anything. But they do come out and join the protest. And now they're doing virtually.
Yeah. Now, you've referred several times to a negotiation, not very fruitful, but negotiation with South Korea. But of course, mm-hmm. these crimes were committed throughout Korea. Is there any effort made to make reparation for the victims in the north?
There was, we believe, that there is a main supporting organization for this victim survivors, that is the Korean Council for the Women drafted for the military sexual slavery system. And until 2000 or late 90s, there were some communications between North and South, and particularly on this issue, because this is something that both sides of Korea experienced very badly, brutally, and something unresolved, something both Koreas, regardless ideologies of both sides, could agree upon. So victims were visiting, and victims from the north side of Korea visited Seoul to participate in some, you know, Asian conference, Asian women's conference, etc. But as much as South Koreans wouldn't and don't know about how the North Korean government is doing, it is not much known. However, when I personally met with North Korean officials who are working at the UN, she said that their government never stopped to, you know, work on this issue, and they constantly demanding justice for these victims. And they were actually, you know, unlike South Korean victims, South Korean victims had to deal with and fight the South Korean government on top of the Japanese government and the international community. But at least the North Korean government doesn't seem to be having that relationship with the victims. That's what I could say, I think.
Japan has quite a benign reputation now in the West. But of course, in the parts of Asia that the fascist empire conquered and raped and pillaged and murdered on a mass scale, it doesn't seem quite so benign, does it?
It doesn't. And it is actually very hard to resolve this issue, because not only because it is old and, you know, it is already 75 years ago when it happened, and Japan denied, and it is not, you know, that there's, although there is so much evidence disclosed, and Japan just denies it. It is the Japanese presence that is very strong in the international community, so that even if victim survivors make speeches or give testimonies, this difficult things and this hard work and protests and all these, it is the international community makes only recommendations to Japan do something about it. And that's how several attempts of just close out and wash off this history kind of gestures have been made.
What, finally, and I'm grateful for your time, why do you think Japan refuses to even go through decent motions of atoning for the crimes of Japanese fascism? They were rich enough to do so. They're always bowing and scraping to each other and others. Why can't they bow to the victims of the Japanese fascist empire? Why can't they compensate their victims? What stops them, do you think, from fully coming to terms with, in the way that the German government has done? Why can't the Japanese do that?
I think for the Japanese government, admission of the war crimes is something that they have to give in their what they want to do, what they have wanted to do, which is changing their peace constitution so that they could have their own military. And they always have had this desire, this ambition to have their own military and conquer the world, and, you know, just like they had the fascist empire at the time 75 years ago and even longer. And if and also realistically, I think the current government and the cabinet of the Japan is consists of sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters of Class A war criminals. Not all, but many of them. The Prime Minister Shinzo Abe also is one of the ones, and it is for them to denying, I think, themselves who they are, how they grew up, and what they believe. And I think that is very strong.
Very interesting. Koen Lee, thank you very much for joining us. on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Much appreciated. Okay, Joe Biden's at 16%. Donald Trump's up 42%, up 2. And Jesse Ventura at 42%, down 2. It's neck and neck in the American presidential race, but not between Biden and Trump, between Trump and Jesse Ventura. 1,396 people have voted so far, and the poll closes at 8:50 p.m. London time. So you've basically got just less than an hour to get your vote in on that. You can vote on my Twitter feed at George Galloway. Now, as I said right at the beginning, there's been a dramatic surge in coronavirus cases just in the last 24 hours in Britain. It could be just a blip. It could be that they'll go down again tomorrow, or it could do that they will begin to exponentially rise as they did at the height or depth of this particular crisis. Dr. Ranjit Brar, a physician and surgeon, has talked us through this issue right from the beginning. So we wanted to get him on early this evening because this could be very portentous news. Dr. Ranjit, thank you for fitting us in. Were you alarmed, as I was, when you saw those numbers?
George, good to be back with you. I think, yes, George. I mean, if we've been looking at the antibody testing figures, then the estimates actually have been higher than the tests have been showing for some time. And we discussed that probably around 4,000 people untested are catching the virus every day. But of course, a larger number of test positive proven cases indicates that the virus is spreading more widely within society and, of course, is of concern. Not very long ago, we were down well below 1,000 cases a day. It was alarming to people when 1,000 cases was again breached. And as you say, it's gone up to close to 3,000 today and from 2,000 yesterday. So it's a rapid increase. I think there are a number of reasons for it. It's clear that restrictions couldn't be maintained in an absolute lockdown. And as the economy has been opened, as people are encouraged increasingly to go back to work, as the furlough scheme is being wound down, as we're being encouraged to do our bit for the country and go out and eat and be subsidized to do so, as there have been increasing number of parties, as the increasing number of social interactions, as sporting facilities start to come back online, and of course, as children go back to school, then we start to see social conditions which are much more conducive to the spread of the virus. And as we've remarked before, the vast majority of the population have not yet had it, and therefore there is ground for it to spread.
Now, this has not yet resulted in a big spike in hospitalizations, the big spike in deaths. Would you expect that to continue? In which case, what does that say about the virulence of the virus at this point in time?
Thanks, George. Well, it does seem that the virus is not significantly mutated in form. There's been some speculation as to why the deaths have gone down. It does seem to be overwhelmingly the case that it is the younger population who are now being exposed to the virus. So the vast majority of cases that we're seeing are in the under 40-year-olds, and the largest group are the under 20-year-olds. And as we've noted, the peculiar feature of this virus is that its severity increases with age, such that those over 80 have a mortality rate from catching the virus of around 15%, whereas those under 10, you know, no one who doesn't have very severe comorbidity has died from the virus. So there's a real spectrum of severity based upon the age. And it does seem that we have changed our behavior as a country, not just in terms of the mask wearing and in the overall increase in social distancing, though clearly we can't maintain everyone sitting at home forever. That change in behavior particularly has affected those who realize that they're most susceptible. So the elderly, those comorbid populations with heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, and particularly obesity, all of these groups, it seems, are being far more cautious than the average. And it's the relatively younger population who feel themselves reasonably to be at less threat, who are more likely currently to contract the virus. Of course, as we've commented before, what's difficult and what was essentially wrong with the strategy of herd immunity was that you can't really contain the virus. Once it becomes the case that large numbers of people within society have this virus or other viruses, it's very hard to limit it to a particular demographic. There'll be increasing points of contact with those who are vulnerable. And of course, I'm happy that the death rates are currently so low, but it is a real risk if numbers increase that situation does not stay the case and we see an increase in deaths once again, George.
No, I was asked earlier, but I was going to ask you anyway, because my own children are going back to school this coming week, as are the children of many. What does this spike mean for the back-to-school controversy?
I mean, I personally want my children to be back at school. My children are back at school. I'm delighted for them that they're back at school. I think it's genuinely the case that our classrooms are overcrowded. If you look at the difference between the independent or private schools and public or state schools, comprehensive schools, as my children go to comprehensive schools, our class sizes are roughly double those of privately funded education, and that's one of the major assets that they have. So I would personally love to see a reduced class size as a general demand for education for the benefit of all of our children, irrespective of the pandemic. But clearly, if there are outbreaks within schools, and there have been outbreaks within schools, but not a huge number, measures will be taken to close down those particular sections and schools affected. I think that the numbers are sufficiently low that it's reasonable for our children to go back to school. And as I say, mine are. It's a tremendously stifling socially for them not to be back at school. However, you know, do I think overall that we're doing a very good job at controlling the virus? I mean, I think if you look, for example, I was reading the Times today, and they were saying that, look, Wuhan, where we were told the virus spread from, certainly where it was discovered, doesn't seem that it actually came from Wuhan now, but certainly where the virus was first discovered, their public health measures were, you know, so well tailored to their situation throughout that nation that now the Wuhan football team has gone back. They have full sports facilities. They've basically got completely normal running of society, whereas we have gone through a great deal of social dislocation without getting the virus under control. And it's the basic public health measures that we've discussed, you know, perhaps ad nauseum time and again, the adequate isolation, the adequate tracing, the adequate testing. We've got large numbers of tests, but we're not good still at contact tracing and managing to find the people who have the virus and isolate them from the rest of the community in a safe way, you know, which doesn't you know, affect their freedoms, but keeps them taken care of and safely away from spreading it to the rest of the population. So all of those measures, really, that China, Vietnam, and other countries, the Koreas, were able to put into effect were due to really good mobilization of the health resources and economic resources of the country, putting the lives of the people first, which has allowed us to get back them to get back to normal without the advent of a vaccine. And speaking of vaccines, perhaps we could have a quick word about the Sputnik vaccine, because I think there is more.
I was just about to turn to that. The Sputnik is now orbiting the world. 20 countries have ordered it. It's in stage three, but all the reports are giving it a clean bill of health, at least everything I've read.
Yeah, and I was very encouraged by the fact that the phase one and phase two trials have now been published in The Lancet just a couple of days ago. So I was able to read them. They're accessible in English. They're accessible, therefore, to the wider medical community. And it's an extremely thorough vaccination based on an adenovirus vector. So adenovirus is essentially a virus similar to the common cold, so a safe vector. Two different adenoviruses, because this the basic premise for the virus will be that you'll get a first dose, and then on day 14 you'll get a second dose of the vaccine with a slightly different adenovirus vector, so that you don't get cross reactivity between those two vectors. So essentially a dose and then a boost dose given shortly after, and the levels of immunity were absolutely comparable to the population who had actually caught coronavirus and recovered in a similar time frame. So essentially the virus does induce a state of immunity without having the primary disease and the ill effects of the disease of those who have recovered from the coronavirus. So that is incredibly optimistic. They themselves, as their conclusion, say, look, the safety profile was excellent, and the safety profile was absolutely, you know, the side effects of this were things you expect to see with any standard vaccination that people will be familiar with, and that's in terms of a little bit of pain at the injection site, having a temperature, having some aches, and feeling a little bit of weakness and being unwell for a day or two. So, you know, all the standard things that one might expect with any adenovirus vaccination. I think they have themselves said that they were able to accelerate their development of the vaccine, both in terms of the face of the emergency of the pandemic that they were facing, but also in terms of their experience at the Gamaleya Institute, treating, as we've said, Ebola and previous SARS viruses. So I think they've used all their expertise. They've come up with what looks like to be a very effective vaccine, and they've published phase one and phase two, and they have therefore, in accordance with the emergency laws which were passed in August by the Russian Federation, have been allowed to issue the virus to a wider population in an accelerated manner, but simultaneously and as part of a wider pharmacognoscence, a wider trial. A phase three trial, as you say, and they're planning to do that initially at 40,000 volunteers. So essentially it's an accelerated program of development which looks extremely promising and is being rolled out across Russia, particularly to the high-risk population. Yeah. The caveats of the trial, many of the participants initially were from a relatively young, relatively healthy military background, some of them. It was a preponderance of males in the trial. All of those things are reasonable, but there's no reason to suspect that that would really have a huge impact upon the efficacy of the vaccine. But anyway, more data will be forthcoming. But it's fantastic news, I think, that it essentially shows a way through the pandemic, certainly for those countries who adopt the virus, this vaccination. And I think that's tremendously encouraging for the world to have developed this so soon.
Good news out of Russia. Who'd have thunk it? Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Ranjit Brar, the Moat's medic. Now, I better take a call from Peter, because he's not happy about me on coronavirus. That's why he's up next. Go ahead, Peter.
Hello, George.
Hi.
I've just noticed over the last few weeks that I just felt like you were, you know, maybe months now, just stifling any sort of talk about the origins of this, except
you're the first call on immediately. That's how stifling we are, Peter.
I'm looking at the YouTube chat earlier, and it's saying, we don't want you talking about this. And I do remember you saying, you know, a couple of months ago, I can't remember, but you're saying, you know, you didn't want to talk about conspiracy theories about it.
No, I don't want to talk about conspiracy theories because they're dangerous. But that's not stifling genuine debate. That's why the floor is now yours. On you go.
Well, I mean, just, you know, when we're talking about these things, you know, you've just had a guy on about 9/11. And even with the COVID-19 thing, the origins of coronavirus, you have Whitney Webb on. And, you know, she's done great work over the last few months and years, sort of. And, you know, there's a lot of questions still to be answered about, you know, where this all came from and who is behind it all, ultimately.
Okay, well, don't keep talking about the questions. Ask them. Put them.
Well, I mean, since I spoke to you last time, I've took this up quite keenly, and I've done a lot of looking about and research, and you know, some people might say, "Oh, well, you know, you're just getting stuff off the internet."
But, yeah, I probably would have.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there we go, George. I mean,
admitting it. Research on the internet. Have you got any background in medicine or science?
Well, I don't think that's the way to look at it, George.
No? Well, go on. I'm not stopping you. Go on.
Well, I mean, look, you know, looking at how I see the top of the tree of this, how much thought or, you know, looking at the work of the Rockefeller lockstep thing, and also the American thing that you'll have saw in the John Pilger documentary about the vision for 2010 and 2020. How much have you looked at that?
I know nothing about Rockefeller's lockstep program or John Pilger's 2010 or 2020. So why don't you tell us?
Well, it's a thing that calls for a power grab on the back of a pandemic. And, you know, I think that we need to open our eyes to the Malthusian aspects of oligarchy, considering that the Rockefellers, you know how powerful these people have been in the American political game over the last 100 years, were the first billionaires. And, it seems to me that they have questions to answer.
The questions are. Stop hinting darkly and tell us what the questions are.
Well, there's two things straight away that ring alarm bells for me. One is the meningitis vaccine program that's well documented, and you can find it written up, that was ran in Kansas, in Fort Riley, before the Spanish flu broke out. And that was basically a meningitis vaccine program where they were taking vaccines out of horses that were riddled with flu and trying to immunize soldiers against something. And them soldiers seemed to fall ill. And the next thing, they're being sent to France. And there's also horses dying on the way to France, you know? And if we fast forward to 2013, there's an NGO that's partnered with Rockefellers that seems to have found a virus 96% the same as coronavirus, which is nearer than the SARS-1 virus. There's also elements of our own, I'll just say, the Wellcome Trust, who seem to be involved with this as well. A certain knight of our realm, who was in Ho Chi Minh City when they found this virus. He very quickly became the head of the Wellcome setup. He set up CEPI, which I invite you to go and have a look at. In Davos, so that tells you what you need to know about that.
It doesn't. None of these. All you're doing is throwing out names and places and inferring that tells me all I need to know. But so far, and you've been on some minutes, Peter, you haven't actually told me anything. What is your point? What's your point?
Well, my point is that this is a big thing, like 9/11. That you probably couldn't describe in a few minutes. But all the same...
Is your point that the virus has been caused by vaccination?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, I do believe that if you look at October the 10th, you'll see that all NATO personnel, including the soldiers in America, were given a vaccination. Some of them went to Wuhan. And I do believe there's something that we should be looking at, because the same vaccination companies that gave them vaccinations are now making a fortune out of the vaccines.
Who's making a fortune out of the vaccine? There is no vaccine. There's only a Russian vaccine.
Well, you know, we know that also linked to the Ho Chi Minh thing that I spoke about a minute ago, there is an Oxford vaccine So the guy that was running the Oxford University thing in Ho Chi Minh City, where they found this 96% the same strain in 2013, that is our British vaccine, the Glaxo
vaccine. There is no British vaccine. It hasn't been developed yet.
It hasn't been developed yet. But
so nobody's making a fortune out of it?
What did Sanofi and GSK sign up?
All you're doing is throwing out names. This is classic internet research. Find a Jewish name, throw it out. Find a Davos, throw it out. Bilderberg, you're maybe coming to. None of these things establish anything in my mind. Now, I was ready to listen to you, but you've been a terrible disappointment, Peter. I'm very sorry to hear it. Ranjit is still on the line. Let's see if he can respond to that. Ranjit, sorry, I have little patience. You've got a better bedside manner than me. What would you say to Peter?
It was a little bit of a damp squib, I'm afraid, George. I was expecting to hear something a little more substantial. It's very hard to answer when direct evidence or even coherent kind of story or theme is put together. There are more coherent stories and themes. Normally they're built around Bill Gates. So what you do hear, used to hear very consistently, is that because slightly before this pandemic spread out, Bill Gates has been involved in virus simulation modeling, and there was something called Event 106. I'm not sure. They had essentially an exercise in Baltimore where they simulated a pandemic spreading out, and they predicted it might be a coronavirus in line with the fact that there had been MERS and SARS. So on the basis of that, you hear a lot of conspiracy theorists. But again, nothing concrete, nothing that you can kind of put your finger on. There are different, either the virus is a bioweapon or it doesn't exist. And sometimes you find it's people who simultaneously hold the view that it doesn't really exist and it's not a threat and it is a bioweapon. So why would we be using a bioweapon that doesn't actually have any danger or threat? It's very difficult to determine. So, anything that isn't clearly understood. So without knowledge, I think ignorance spreads. Clearly, the pandemic is affecting many people's lives. And I think the fact that despite the fact that there are many deaths to many, many people, it's essentially harmless. It's something that's quite difficult for people to get their heads around sometimes. So, there's an understandable disquiet in our societies about the level of social control, about the levels of surveillance, about very real social phenomena, about the levels of unemployment, about economic problems. So there's real social discontent. I think without a strong understanding of the causes of those social discontents, all kinds of half-baked theories form in people's mind. And certainly the internet is rife with this kind of speculation. On top of that, I think we genuinely do have agents of disinformation who spread disinformation throughout the population in order to keep them confused and pliable. So there's a whole mixture of real and imaginary phenomenon which go into making up a lot of confusion about the coronavirus. Certainly that particular caller, it's very difficult to answer them on the basis they didn't really say much, George.
Well, I certainly couldn't put it any better than that. Magisterial. Thank you very much, Dr. Ranjit. Poll one, if you could vote in the US election, who would you vote for? Joe Biden, 16. Donald Trump, 43. Up one. He's moved ahead. Jesse Ventura, 41. Down one. You can still vote on my Twitter feed for the next 22 minutes or so, though 1,827 of you already have. So you can do that on my Twitter feed at George Galloway. Now, the most significant courtroom drama of this century begins tomorrow in the Old Bailey. You'll know, if you've been following this show over the years, that we fly the flag for Julian Assange, the greatest journalist and publisher of our era, a world historic figure whose work will be remembered forever. Unfortunately, if the court case goes the wrong way, we may never see Julian Assange again, and we may never see any further work from him. Because if it goes the wrong way, and he is sent into the maw of the US injustice system, he will disappear for the rest of his life, for the rest of all of our lives. One of the campaigners who has been stalwart in pressing the importance of this case is Dr. Deepa Driver, who's an academic and a trade unionist, a member of the National Executive Committee of UCU, the University and College Union. And Dr. Deepa joins us now in London. Doctor, thank you for doing so. Just sketch for us, what's happening tomorrow? How long is it going to last? And most importantly, how are you feeling about how it's going to go?
Firstly, George, I'd like to thank you and those of your viewers who support Julian. It's a very, very difficult time for his family and for supporters, because not only has Julian suffered 10 years of arbitrary detention, as the UN Special Rapporteur puts it, he's now in Belmarsh Maximum Security Prison. And tomorrow a trial will start, which the first part of which happened in February, a couple of weeks in February. And now we will have four further weeks at the Old Bailey this time. And the trial will seek to come to a decision about whether to extradite Julian to the US, where he faces 175 years in a US supermax. Once he gets there, the situation is absolutely horrendous. He will be put under something they call, euphemistically call, special administrative measures, which are essentially these, they're called SAMs. And what happens under these SAMs is neither you nor your lawyer can speak to the outside world, which is essentially confines you to the bowels of a maximum security prison where neither you nor your lawyers can speak to the press, no information can come out about you. And essentially, it's an even worse form of breaking Julian down that they're going for. And we know from the torture that Chelsea Manning experienced, where she was locked up in a small cage when she was originally found out and then further ill-treated and tortured, that the US forces are absolutely brutal. And their intention, and this is something that Juan Passarelli, who is one of the WikiLeaks people, said the other day, is not to set a chilling precedent through the persecution of Julian Assange, because that chilling precedent has already been set. Unlike you, most of the mainstream commentators have, until very recently, been extremely afraid to say anything about the case. And even lawyers and judges in the UK are only now waking up to how horrendous the treatment of Julian has been. So thank you for allowing me to come here and make his case.
Now, the process to date has been deeply flawed. I could go on, so could you, for the rest of the evening about the abuse of process in this case, from the choice of judge, who should never have been placed in charge of this case, to the failure to allow the prisoner to have proper access to his lawyers, not even allowed to sit with them in the courtroom, being strip searched umpteen times every day that he goes to court, being exposed to a coronavirus epidemic in the prison, which has cut down warders and prisoners and led to his virtual total isolation whilst being untried, not in prison for any crime, being held there pending an extradition hearing. So this one case, 3 weeks, is not going to be the end of it, is it? Because every one of those abuses or process that I mentioned is subject to appeal?
Well, it is, whichever way the case goes, it is likely that the case will go to appeal. But the reality is, when somebody has been exposed to torture for such a prolonged period of time in such an evil and horrendous way, we don't know when their body gives up. And this is something that Doctors for Assange, an international grouping of doctors, have been trying to make the point about, which is that nobody knows the effects of prolonged psychological torture on the body. Julian, for example, currently is in a lot of pain because he has a frozen shoulder. He's got he had an untreated tooth for a very long time, and anybody who's had tooth pain knows what that's like. He has a chronic lung condition. You can hear him coughing every time he comes to court and has to say a few words. So Julian cannot be the martyr for free speech. He has a young family, much like yours, George. He's got a one-year-old and a three-year-old. And he is a man who's being tormented every day. Those of us who have been in lockdown know how hard it is to be without association. And people in the prison, including Julian, are under lockdown 23 and a half hours a day. This is an extremely intelligent, articulate, hugely skilled man. And for him to be treated in this way, for the first 3 months that he was in the prison, they lost his glasses and couldn't find them. You know, the Irish prisoners, of course, know of this kind of humiliating and horrible treatment that people have endured. For a long time, Julian has been deprived of his papers. For example, he's going into the hearing tomorrow without having met his lawyers and without having seen some of the papers. So he's fighting for his life without even knowing what the other side is putting in front of him. So his lawyers aren't able to take instructions. Since February until very recently, his lawyers weren't even able to properly converse with him. So this is an utter show trial. Not only this, Julian's privileged conversations with his lawyers, with his physicians, have been spied upon. He's been subject to the most horrendous vilification and smearing. And what this does to an individual, he's had people say, oh, he's having mental health issues. If you kick somebody in the stomach and then say, oh, they have a stomach issue, then, you know, that's the equivalent, because essentially he's being tortured.
Well, Doctor, let's pause for a moment on the spying. In any decent jurisdiction deserving of the name of a justice system, this one abuse alone would invalidate the entire proceedings. That the other side in the case, the U.S. government, has had now for years in its possession the privileged conversations between Julian and his lawyers. This makes a fair trial completely impossible. It makes it a farce.
Indeed, and you know, not only do we have that problem in terms of the US system, you also have a problem here. A declassified UK, Mark Curtis and Matt Kennard and others have reported how the judge presiding over Julian's case has serious and material conflicts of interest, including conflicts of interest in relation to her son, including conflicts of interest in relation, or at least perceived conflicts of interest in relation to herself and her husband. And these kinds of conflicts of interest would require a judge to recuse themselves in any other case, as far as I can see. And I'm a lay observer like any other citizen. I would expect that at least in Britain, Julian would get due process. But even here, there is no chance of him getting a fair trial. And how can he be fit to stand trial in this condition? So you're absolutely right, George. You know, on every single ground, this case should have been thrown out long ago, and it's very clearly politically motivated.
Any chance of Trump pardoning him?
it is the Trump administration that has gone after him. So one of the things that has been made clear in various discussions is that although, you know, Obama himself is a war criminal in terms of drone warfare, but the Obama administration didn't intend to go after him because they thought that if they prosecuted him, they would have to go after the New York Times. But the Trump administration has been a lot more aggressive and has taken steps which criminalize journalism in a way that is completely unthinkable. So, no, I'm not holding my breath for Trump to pardon him.
Well, if he's watching tonight, President Trump, no good can come of this. No good can come of it. I'll not waste my breath appealing to the judge in the British courtroom. I take my hat off, Dr. Deepa, to you and all your fellow campaigners. Everyone will be outside the court tomorrow. What time is it at?
The trial starts at 10 a.m. George, there's only 4 spaces, as far as I know so far, for the public, which means people will be queuing from before 4 a.m. in order to be able to get in.
Yeah. But there'll be a protest, there'll be a gathering outside.
From 9 a.m.
From 9 a.m. at the Old Bailey. Dr. Deepa Driver, God bless you and thanks, and may God bless all of your efforts. Thanks very much for joining us. He's just finished his own radio show, which is a music show, which he does twice a week. So we've only got him on audio, but I'm glad to say he joins me now. Norman Baker, welcome.
George, nice to speak to you again.
Now, I actually read all of your book. It is brilliant. It is a tour de force. It goes into the corners of the royal family and its relationship to the rest of us, financial, political, and so on, in a very forensic and brilliantly written way. But even your book and even your skill as a writer could not have made up what has happened in the last few months. I presume your update covers those.
Very much so. And I must say my sales force of Prince Andrew and Prince Harry have been out there selling my book for me, doing their best to promote it, in behaving in ways which I think most people, including no doubt members of his family, find extraordinary. As you say, Prince Andrew is facing severe calls from the United States to give evidence. He had that car crash interview with Emily Maitlis on BBC when apparently he couldn't remember having an arm around that 17-year-old, Virginia Roberts, but was able, nevertheless, to remember exactly the time and date when he visited a Pizza Express restaurant in Woking. So I think people found his interview calamitous and unbelievable, and it's gone really from bad to worse. You mentioned he was frightened of extradition. Well, it's a little-known fact, and I've put this in my updated version, which actually is out tomorrow, so your program is very well timed for me, that he engaged the barrister who defended General Pinochet when he was subject to an attempt to extradite him. So clearly he has that worry on his mind.
Now, what would be the... There's no precedent for that. I mean, no government has ever sought to extradite a member of the British royal family. So there's no case history, as it were. What would be his protection in diplomatic immunity and so on? Does he have diplomatic immunity?
Well, that's an interesting question, because he would do were he a serving member of the royal family, a working royal, as it were, although they don't work very much. The question is whether that's still the case. Now, he has stopped being a working royal. He has, however, retained his HRH status, as has Prince Harry, and that's not an insignificant matter. What it means is that they can still claim, for example, security support at public expense. They can claim travel at public expense. So even though they're not working royals, they get that benefit, and they probably get the benefit of protection as well. So the answer is probably quite difficult to extradite them. But nevertheless, I'm sure the Americans would like to do so.
But what's the justification for refusing to go to the United States and answer these questions?
Well, from his point of view, there's none. I mean, if he's entirely innocent, as he maintains consistently in the palace, shriek out loud to say so, then why doesn't he simply answer the questions which they're putting? If he, for instance, the Metropolitan Police have records going back 30 years as to where all the Royal Protection Officers were at any particular point, and therefore it's very well easy to establish where Prince Andrew's Protection Officers were on any particular date. And if he was at Pizza Express in working, that will show up on their records. Now, I've put a Freedom of Information request in for the information, but they're not keen to release it. But Prince Andrew, if he's entirely innocent, should be releasing that information himself.
Himself, indeed. What's the reason, what's the justification for the FBI not coming here to question him?
Well, I imagine that there's been quite a lot of pressure put on by the British government to avoid the embarrassment of the situation. And that's historically what's happened in the past. If you look back at to the end of the Second World War, this is also in my book in the chapter called Germany Calling.
Oh, brilliant chapter. Brilliant.
Thank you. Well, there was a lot of information there, George, as you know, about Edward VIII and his embarrassing activities and how the British government, after the Second World War, when it should have been rebuilding Britain, this is the Labour government who did quite a lot of good things, but they spent a huge amount of diplomatic money, as it were, trying to persuade the Americans to destroy information about Edward VIII. So they go to extraordinary lengths, don't they, to protect the royal family. So I imagine that's part of the problem.
Now, Harry and Meghan, as far as we know, have not been up to anything insalubrious, but they have abandoned the country and have allowed to gain momentum the thesis that they were driven out of the country because Meghan is black, of mixed race.
Well, I think there's no doubt that she found it difficult to assimilate herself into the rather starchy Windsor family. And there is a history of not liking what they would call uppity women. Look at what happened to Princess Diana, who also sailed off in the direction of her own. And I imagine that when you do that, then that's not very welcome. Royal women are expected to paint their fingernails, keep their knees together, simper when their husbands are around and say nothing. It's a very 1950s attitude, it hasn't changed. And clearly Meghan, as an independent woman, found this very difficult. So I can quite understand why she felt it very suffocating, and Harry appears to be fully in love with her and therefore would support her, and also he was reasonably independent-minded too. So the fact that they've gone off, I've got some sympathy with, and if they want to go and make money in Hollywood, that's up to them. I don't have a problem with that. What I do have a problem with is when they keep one foot in the royal camp and one foot outside. Harry has kept, as I mentioned a moment ago, his HRH status. That means that at this moment, we, the taxpayers, are paying for security guards to wander around Frogmore Cottage in Windsor Great Park, which, of course, he abandoned very shortly after $2.3 million of public money being spent on it. We're paying for the security of that. We'll pay for the travel when they come back to the UK. And to my mind, that's not on. If he wants to leave the royal family, he should be allowed to do so. But he has to leave it, not half leave it, and claim financial support when it suits him.
Yes, and that goes for the title also, doesn't it? Why would
you
want to continue to be known as His Royal Highness if you'd given the whole show up?
Well, indeed. I can only think that it's either egotism or, in fact, it's seemed to be beneficial when he's negotiating deals with people like Netflix. But at least he's His Royal Highness. Prince Andrew, of course, was known in diplomatic circles as His Buffoon Highness, HBH.
Well, you could say that. I couldn't possibly comment. I'd end up in the tower. Finally, reissued copies are what, online, or are they in the bookshops tomorrow in paperback?
Yes, I think hopefully they're everywhere, George. I mean, certainly they're on Amazon, and there is an audiobook actually as well, an audiobook version, but that's of the hardback rather than the paperback, and certainly it's online. So I know a couple of people have already had it delivered, actually, which it shouldn't have done ahead of Monday, but a couple of people I know got it yesterday when they ordered it.
It's totally brilliant.
Thank you.
How's your music career doing?
Well, I think I've probably ticked that box after 25 years with the band and releasing three albums. So I think I'll probably leave it there. My music these days is, as you said in your introduction, my music show is here on Sea Haven FM, my local FM station. And I've just done an hour of blues, which I love, and an hour of 70s hits, which I also do. And tomorrow night, my other time I'm with the station, I do what's called Hidden 60s, when I play material from the 1960s, which people don't know, like B-sides and EP tracks and so on.
Fantastic. You're a cool cat. Norman Baker, Right Honourable, former Lib Dem MP and Minister. Now, last comments on Facebook and so on. Deborah says, so if this wasn't a conspiracy, then it was a series of coincidences. Many, many, many coincidences, all creating a perfect attack. Not convinced by the probability of all those coincidences, says Deborah. And Martin says, the design of the building was not designed to be struck from the outside by a 179-ton bird. And on email, Chris says, World Trade Center 7, George. It was the third tower to fall down that day, and no plane hit it. The planes hit Tower 1 and 2. So you accept it, Chris, that the planes hit Tower 1 and 2. Good. Go on, he says. Please correct yourself and don't ridicule me, who has the correct facts. Not at all. No ridicule intended. Nestor is in Maryland on 9/11. Let's go with it, Nestor.
Hey, thank you for giving me a chance to talk. I know you've been asking every caller, like, you know, what is the reason and why would United States need to, you know, create this narrative, create this cover-up? You know, it's simple. It goes back to the U.S. history that they've been creating narratives to do what they have to do. You know, for example, with Julian Assange, they can't just tell the U.K. Government to hand over Julian Assange because he embarrassed them by exposing their war crimes. And if they don't, they will bomb them to kingdom come. You know, it's just, even though someone has the
that's
power
a bit of a
to
straw,
commit
that's
violence.
That's a straw man, Nestor. Let's actually not look in the crystal ball, but look at the book. Why did the United States have to kill thousands of its own people in such an elaborate conspiracy to justify a war against Afghanistan? Tell me.
Well, after the Soviet Union fell, the United States had this huge apparatus of military-industrial complex, which it no longer had a way to justify to keep. And and they had to come up with a way and a reason to have this military power and to convince the world that they needed to still be the one and sole superpower in the world and something that they could trust. So they needed to play the victim card. They needed something that would give that narrative and say, hey, we have this new enemy called terrorism, and look what they did to us. Look how they were able to attack the strongest, most powerful nation in the world. I was in seventh grade when I saw this happen, George. I was watching live as well, watching those planes hit those towers, and I knew right there and then something was very off, that something like this could happen to the most powerful were a country in the world that had no rival to equal its own might, and there was that is my why they would have to do some narrative like that to convince the world that the world needs this superpower, this military superpower, to exist.
And do you think George Bush himself presided over this atrocity?
Oh no, presidents have been. More or less, presidents throughout the U.S. history have been more or less than puppets to, you know, say that this is what speaks for the people, because, you know, we have a democracy and we can vote people in, and this somehow represents the will of the people. The United States American Empire agenda has been a monster of its own. And regardless of what presidents have been in power, they have had to follow the agenda, because the moment, just like JFK Kennedy chose not to follow that agenda, he was assassinated cold-bloodedly. And this is the case. Every president knows that they have to straw, they have to maintain that line. They have to say, we must make our military stronger. They all say the same thing, because at the moment they step out of line, they know that they're is in the crosshairs.
Nestor in Maryland, last call of the night, I'm afraid, but thank you very much indeed for making it. Carl says, the Royals, even no news becomes news. Isn't it time for this archaic system to just disappear? Ken says their Netflix show should be called Shame of Thrones. That's a good one. And Hannah says, remarkably harried. And Martin says, don't people today still die from complications from the flu? Don't we have a flu vaccine? Why would the results be any different with a COVID vaccine? Our people are lacking common sense. Trump 2020, says Martin. We can do this. Well, there you go. It's been marvelous for me. I hope it was for you. And if it was, come back at the same time and the same place next week and bring another listener, bring another viewer with you. Why don't you? I'm going home to take some Lemsip and go to bed because I've got a pretty bad cold. Thanks for sticking with me.